Welcome to the City Club of Eugene. My name is Eric Richardson, and I serve as president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. You are also able, through our website, to present any kind of ideas around programming that you might want to see. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. The University of Oregon. Since 1876, the university has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As our hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, their mission has been to keep you and your families healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And Lane Community College, who transforms lives through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. More information can be found at lanecc.edu/programs. We'd also like to acknowledge the generous support of the City of Eugene, for which we work and serve. So please, I'd like to move on to today's program by welcoming today's program coordinator. Please welcome to the mic, Joel Corin.
The usual way that we have moved things forward is have a disaster and then respond to it. And somebody decides they want to blow up a plane with an explosive in their shoes, and the rest of us are taking off their shoes for years to come before we can get on an airplane. Maybe we don't have to do that. Dr. Lucy Jones, who is our speaker today, came up with a wild concept called planning ahead. And she was able to convince the California legislature to pass seismic safety legislation even when there wasn't a major earthquake in California. And then began thinking, what else can we do to use that concept, this wild concept of planning ahead, with respect to climate policy? And that's what she's going to talk about today, planning ahead before the disaster happens. Dr. Jones, if you watch TV during the California earthquake, Dr. Jones was a constant presence. She was on TV more than Lester Holt. She has an incredible background. She's a seismologist, a natural disaster expert, and she worked at the U.S. Geological Survey, where she led to the creation of national science strategy for all the natural hazards studied by the USGS to promote science that would better prepare the nation for future natural disasters, and the development of science products that would make information more accessible to decision makers. She also has founded the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society, with a mission to foster the understanding and application of scientific information. She wrote the book, The Big One, and is also research associate at the Seismological Laboratory at Caltech. Now, in addition to that, I learned at the table that she has also walked the red carpet with The Rock at the premiere of a movie called San Andreas. I've never introduced a speaker that has been on the red carpet before. Now, Dr. Jones is here in Oregon as the Wayne Morse Chair with the Wayne Morse Center at the University of Oregon. She established in 1983, the Wayne Morse Chair honors Senator and a former Dean of the UO Law School, Wayne L. Morse. Other people who have held this position have been Judge Abner Mikva, Chief Wilma Mankiller, Senator Russ Feingold, Vandana Shiva, Joseph Antonio Vargas. Dr. Jones is the first scientist to hold this post. Now, some of the concepts she will talk about today are difficult concepts and may be hard to explain. But in the words of that immortal 1950s and 60s great philosopher, Ricky Ricardo, "Lucy, you got some explaining to do."
You know, I Love Lucy was one of the worst things about growing up named Lucy in the 60s, and still coming back for me. Thank you for having me. I'm trying to figure out how much background to give. I had to listen to how much they wanted to tell here, and it's sort of a sign you know you're getting old when you're looking at how much time you need to explain what brought you to the place that you are. As you heard, I'm a research seismologist. I spent most of my career with the U.S. Geological Survey researching earthquake statistics, trying to explain risk to people, trying to explain probabilities. Came to realize that while people may understand probabilities, they pretty clearly don't make decisions with probabilities. And I needed to really shift what I was doing if I wanted our science used to make a difference in California. So my role was always in Southern California. I was stationed at Caltech for all of my career, and I completed my federal service 3 years ago. I'm still associated with Caltech. And in this process of saying, how do we get our science used? We reached a point where we had the opportunity to create a new program and try and connect. And we spent time talking to stakeholders in the Southern California community. What do you want from science that you're not getting? And the most important message we got is we want scenarios of what these disasters are. We know we're supposed to be getting ready for an earthquake, but we don't know what the earthquake is. And that process of being asked to do this helped me shift my science towards really looking at the impacts of the disasters and putting it into terms that could be received by policymakers. And then proceeded to start doing more and more work with policymakers, and I actually spent the year of 2014 at Los Angeles City Hall working with the mayor to help develop seismic safety policies. Since then, and especially once I'm no longer a government employee constrained to talk only about what my own individual science is, I have found myself, as I understand more about what's happening with the climate crisis, finding it difficult to argue to spend much effort on seismic safety. What is coming from the climate crisis, if we do nothing, could well wipe out our society before the earthquake up here especially has any time to happen. So I've been really trying to understand what comes together. How do I look at the science? How do I look at the communication? And I've come to believe that we are dealing with actually a very similar problem when dealing with seismic policy or climate policy. In both cases, you're having to listen to scientists come up with a relatively abstract idea. We create models, we study the data, create a model, say, according to our model, I can tell you what's coming in the future, and it's gonna be something awful. And if you don't wanna suffer that something awful, you really gotta do something now to change it. But you're having to listen to the abstract model of the scientist and process that to spend money now to prevent a future harm. And that's a really difficult problem to get. It's even more difficult for elected officials. When I was doing this work with Mayor Garcetti, there was an editorial about it in a local newspaper, and it's talked about why elected officials have always ignored seismic safety. Said there's only, you know, if they go and they invest political capital, they invest money and effort towards trying to change something about the earthquake risk, there's only two possible outcomes. One, there's no earthquake before they're out of office, and the people look at them and said, why'd you waste the money? Or there will be an earthquake before they're out of office, and their programs won't have had time to make a difference, and they'll look ineffective. So that it was always a lose-lose for any elected official to deal with the problem. And historically, I think that's right. And what I want to do today is to look at about how we have addressed earthquake issues in California, where we've had successes, where we've had failures, and then think about what lessons we can learn from that to how we apply it to the climate crisis. The first seismic policies really got started about 100 years ago in California. There's one significant difference between California and Oregon. We both have really big earthquakes in our future, but California has moderate earthquakes now. And it is without question that those have helped us focus and understand what's coming. And of course, the first earthquakes, the 1925 Santa Barbara earthquake that destroyed a lot of Santa Barbara, was at a time when we really didn't understand much about how the earthquake process happened. In fact, go back a little bit more, the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. There, you probably have heard of it as, you know, it was always talked about as the San Francisco earthquake and fire. And there was a lot of discussion about how it was really the fire that had destroyed the city. That was partly a political calculation that everybody had fires, and therefore, if you had a fire destroy the city, it wouldn't keep people away. But they didn't want to look like particularly dangerous about earthquakes. And as there's actually, over time, we've been able to go and, you know, people have really dug into what happened there and how it was talked about. There are pictures from between the earthquake and the fire that have been doctored to make it look like the buildings were in better shape before the fire came through and destroyed them, right? Yeah, and the estimates actually are about 3,000 dead. It's hard to tell very much because people got up and left. But at the time, we didn't know, and the standard line was actually that earthquakes were like lightning and they never struck twice in the same place. That was also promoted out of San Francisco, again, to keep people from running away. And in fact, people did run away. The largest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles is the decade after the 1906 earthquake, as people gave up on Northern California and moved south to what seemed like a safer place. Of course, it wasn't. 1925, we had an earthquake that badly damaged Santa Barbara and began the first discussions about building codes. You know, we could be building differently if we wanted to. It took the 1933 earthquake to really make a difference. That earthquake happened at about 6 o'clock in the evening on March 10th and completely destroyed 70 schools and damaged a total of about 700 schools, as well as lots of buildings. Because at the time, most of Long Beach was built of brick to be able, for fire safety. Right? Brick is absolutely the worst possible construction type for earthquakes. I know there are discussions about brick buildings and generally what's called unreinforced masonry, URMs, here in Oregon. They really are bad. I like to call them FPRs for future piles of rubble. The mortar between the bricks dissolves under shaking. If that brick wall is holding up a roof, the roof comes down. Lots and lots of people die. Because of the 1933 earthquake, we got the first seismic provisions ever had in a building code, and we said we aren't going to build brick buildings in California. So our brick buildings in California are all pre-1935. And that was a really very big change. However, nobody was willing to say get rid of brick buildings in other cities. We don't know where the earthquake's going to be. That's going to cost a lot of money. We aren't going to do that. The other thing it brought us is what was called the Field Act. Exactly 1 month after the earthquake, the Field Act was passed, mandating special construction standards for schools and state-level continuous inspection while a building was being built. And that continuous inspection is probably the most important thing. There is somebody on site at all times when a public school is being built. And if they Wait a minute, the plans say 4 feet, you've only dug 3, keep on digging. Wait a minute, you're supposed to have 10 nails there, you've only put in 5, go back. And that happens, and the result has been that Field Act buildings are the safest buildings in the state. Since the Field Act was in place, we have not had a collapse of a Field Act building. Some of the ones built in the 40s have been damaged in later earthquakes, but the level of damage is way, way down. The best comparison, so our community colleges fall under the Field Act because they came out of our high schools. They were trade schools. The state universities do not fall under this because you're going there voluntarily. The Field Act applied to schools that you were told you had to go to. And to actually make it worse, local jurisdictions have no authority over the state, so the local building departments do not inspect state buildings. They're done at the state level. In the 1994 Northridge earthquake, we had 2 community colleges in the receiving the same level of shaking as Cal State Northridge. The one older college, Pierce College, built in the 40s, had $5 million in damage. Mission College, that had been built in the 80s, had no structural damage at all. And Cal State Northridge, receiving the same level of shaking, had $405 million worth of structural damage. So the Field Act has been one of the most successful things we've ever done. I would strongly recommend it as a future method because children are forced to go to school and you're putting them at risk. Okay, that was the first seismic policy in California resulting because of the damage in the Long Beach earthquake. As we went forward, the 1971 San Fernando earthquake almost caused the failure of a dam and caused a brand new hospital to collapse where the first floor got crushed. The second floor came down onto the first one, killing a lot of patients. It was a veterans hospital, a psychiatric hospital. So it was considered particularly egregious failure. And we then got really strong standards for our hospitals and for our dams. Again, we responded to what happened. We did also get different building codes because the failure of that brand new building was able to be seen as being a really significant engineering failure, and we changed out those types of buildings. Unfortunately, those types of buildings are all the concrete buildings built in the 50s and 60s, which describes a lot of Los Angeles, right? At least our commercial structures. It continues that way. The Loma Prieta earthquake caused the collapse of the Nimitz Freeway and the damage to the Bay Bridge. We then invested $10 billion in retrofitting our highways. So we now the highways are probably one of the safer places to be in an earthquake going forward. $10 billion does a lot of retrofitting. We do a great job of preparing for the last earthquake. If you look over that California history, there is no legislation that was ever created without a big earthquake to set it off. And that's true until the last decade. There was a process that got going in San Francisco with the centennial of the 1906 earthquake. It was a very slow process, and over 10 years, they finally came up with a community action plan for seismic safety, which was agreed upon in principle by the San Francisco supervisors. But every actual law has to now be passed individually, and they've managed to pass one of them. As this was going forward, though, Mayor Garcetti got elected in Los Angeles in 2013, and I ended up arranging to go talk with him. We told him about what happened. He was about 2 months after he had been elected. And we were wanting to tell him about what was going on in San Francisco, see if we could get a little, you know, city rivalry going and start to get some sort of similar process that would probably take a long time to try and bring it forward. One part of being really fortunate, it really was a coincidence, but the Los Angeles Times published a huge expose of the problems with these non-ductile concrete buildings, the ones that I said got changed after 71, but still are sitting around Los Angeles. Big spread in the LA Times headline thing. This process had been going on for 2 years, and it happened to be published 2 days before my meeting with the mayor. So I had his attention, and we talked about what was possible and what we could potentially do. He was like, okay, I want to do something, but I'm not taking 10 years. I want it in one. And I was like, oh my God, you do, there's a reason it's a 10-year process. How can you do this? We talked about it a while. I went home and I thought about it. And I realized that I had a level of visibility in Los Angeles that would help this go through. And I suggested, you know, would you like to have me come and partner with you to do this? And they said, yes. I went to the U.S. Geological Survey, and probably the more astonishing part is I convinced them to let me do this, because the USGS is a research organization. They are, you know, their money is appropriated by Congress for doing research. And one thing about a federal agency, you have to do what Congress, you know, if you do use your money for something other than what Congress appropriated it for, you get in a lot of trouble. At least that used to be the case in federal agencies. And so, you know, to convince them to let me go in and try to do this was took some doing, but we ended up agreeing to it. We created a technical assistance agreement that said the survey would put up my time, 75% of my time for a year. The mayor would put up his staff time, and together we would explore how to create a seismic resilience plan for California. And that sort of, that's been this interesting process, because I sort of got to get in there and see in depth and in person how the policy creation process works. And I was able to get some shifting in how it was done that I think has been part of how we got it to work. Just from the very beginning, when we set up this technical assistance agreement, the city said, we're not, you know, this isn't create a seismic safety plan. You know, we'll never make it perfect. We say we're making us safe from earthquakes, and the earthquake happens, and, you know, somebody's injured, we'll look bad. What we had to do was to say we're going to attack three particular problems. We negotiated how many and what we would be doing. And the criteria was that every one of them, we could see something obvious that could be done. We were welcome to go and explore other things, and we structured it so we could put a lot of different things in that structure. But we knew that we could look successful on each of those three items, or could claim success. And that was sort of my first introduction to that political process, which is a really different way of looking at it than the open-ended science way of looking at it. But I also got it, and it was, you know, really, we needed to be able to get to the end. If we wanted people to act, we needed to look successful or they weren't going to be listening to us. So we set up three things of problems of old buildings, the problems in our water system, and problems with telecommunications. That last one's sort of an interesting thing. We were waving our arms and saying, modern society, we need telecommunications. It was also, we knew there was significant issues with the electrical system, and we were really unsure if we could get Los Angeles DWP, the Department of Water and Power, to act on problems with the electrical service. So it was like we created this in a way where we could say we had something else that was successful, and if we could get the Department DWP to move, we could put it in there as part of the process. Spoiler, I'll just tell you that Los Angeles Department of Water and Power really understood their water issues. We have some really big ones, like the pipes in the ground are going to be so badly damaged in the earthquake, it's our estimate it's going to take 6 months to get water back into everybody's houses, problem number one. Problem number two, Los Angeles gets 85% of its water from outside the region, and every drop of that crosses the San Andreas Fault in four different aqueducts. So when the fault goes in a big enough earthquake, every aqueduct gets broken at the same moment. We got a big problem with water, right? But we couldn't get them to believe that they had a power problem. On the power side, they had lost power to the whole city in the Northridge earthquake, and they got it back in 24 hours, which was an amazing accomplishment, and it was central to their identity. We're the people who got it back. We know how to deal with earthquakes. And I'm like, you know, it's going to be a lot bigger when the San Andreas goes. We know how to deal with earthquakes. You know, you're going to be dependent on power coming in from other regions. We know how to deal with earthquakes. And we finally gave up, basically, and backed off. But it didn't look like a failure because we had structured it to make sure that we didn't claim we were going to get that done. I then spent 10 months in Los Angeles City Hall, working with staff. We met every week, creating ideas about how we could address these various issues. And I wanted to go out and start talking with the stakeholders, because we're talking about requiring people to make a lot of changes in their buildings. We really needed to figure out how they could work with us. And this was another sort of my other big lesson. The deputy mayor for public safety that I was working with was just adamant that we couldn't go talk with people until we knew what we were going to say. That if you come out with a half-baked plan, people are going to tear at you, and then they don't listen to you when you got it done. So we need to really get it settled. And I was like, but how do we know what we're going to say until we've talked with people? And I actually went a bit behind their back and was able to ensure that the mayor's office got asked for me to come and talk with the various organizations, which they then weren't going to turn down. And so I ended up doing 130 public meetings over 10 months, if you want to know how to definition of tired, especially for an introvert. May not be obvious, but I am. And then in that process, I had a talk that I called Imagine America Without Los Angeles. That the idea, you're going to live through the earthquake. You know, you're not going to die in the earthquake, but you may not want to live here later. And if we don't have water, if we don't have power, if our businesses can't come back, people are going to give up and leave. Look at what happened in San Francisco in 1906. That could be us this time around. But then also, so here's the problem. And we know why people will leave. We don't have the water, and we've got all these buildings that we know which ones are going to be killing you. We knew, you know, our models of what the big earthquake's going to be like give us 250,000 households that lose their homes. Right? 250,000 housing units get damaged. We think we have a housing problem now, and we do. Imagine taking another 250,000 units out of the process. So we went through this, and then I said, here's the problem. What do we do about it? Instead of saying, here's the problem, here's our solution. I said, here's our problem. We've thought about these things. What do you think would work? And it meant we engaged them in a discussion of their own buildings. And they were part of the process. And by the time we got done, we had a proposal for mandatory retrofits of the buildings. The city paid nothing. The building owners had to pay all of it. But the city committed to paying for the water issues. So we each had done our part, and they understood why. And the Building Owners and Management Association stood with the mayor and said, we support this when he released it. And we ended up being able to pass all of the ordinances unanimously. Right? Yeah. And it is the most extensive legislation ever passed in California, and with or without an earthquake. So why? What was successful? One piece of it is that it was based on this very specific model of what the big earthquake would be. We had created what's called the shakeout scenario. If you participated in the shakeout drill, that was originally created to explain the scenario to people. It's sort of taken on a life of its own. But we had a story, and it was a scientifically defensible story. Scientists usually give their information as a bunch of facts. We explicitly avoid stories because stories are misleading. Anecdotes are not the plural of data. They give us the wrong answer. But in fact, people make decisions with stories. So the shakeout story of what the big earthquake would be allowed an emotional connection to it. I think, as I said, we identified the likely opponents and invited them into the discussions at the beginning. So instead of hitting them straight on and attacking them, which is the best way to strengthen a defense, is to attack it straight on, instead we were engaging them in a discussion, and it felt like they were part of the process, and they could see their fingerprints on the result. Even if we only took a little bit from them, they were part of the process. Mm-hmm. I think it was important that I was there. I gave it scientific credibility, but also I was not hired by the mayor. And I could say to people, and I often did, the price of Mayor Garcetti getting me for free is that he's really getting me, and he has no control over what I'm saying. And that impartiality gave it credibility. And I think that part was really important. And we respected each other. We were able to say, this is my role. I'm providing you science. I did not try to make his decisions for him. I wasn't elected to decide policy for Los Angeles. He was. And so we were able to work together and recognize the places where we fit. One of the interesting things is not only did we get all of this legislation done, it has inspired others. And in the next 4 years, we have seen a dozen other cities adopt mandatory retrofits of these buildings because they saw that Mayor Garcetti didn't get hurt by it. He didn't get looked as, why are you wasting that money? In fact, he got reelected with 81% of the vote. Right? So he got political credibility for doing what was supposed to not have political capital to it. So it was sort of this funny thing, by having the courage to say, I'm going to do something not for political reasons, he got political credit. And I, we're going to run, so now let's take the turn and say, how does this apply to climate change? If you think about what I've said people need a story to form emotional connections. You can't do this through facts and numbers. You've got to help people understand what's really coming. People need to be part of the process. You can't say, we've come up with this solution, take it. Or, you know, and that encourages people to fight back. Instead, if we can, you know, we found a way to connect people as part of creating of it. We had dialogue and respect to people who, you know, from the tenants in the apartments to the apartment owners to the building owners to, you know, all the other stakeholders around the city, we talked together about it. And I think the end result that everybody saw that other people were doing their part. They were being asked to sacrifice, but other people were sacrificing as well. And then again, that science policy boundary, we were able to keep clear, this is what the science says. These are potential approaches. And it's not that the policy and the science came really close together, but we recognized that they were different things. When you think about applying this to climate change, you know, usually you need that big event. It's the same reason you guys never seem to be able to get earthquake policies through, because you don't have the smaller events to be able to help remind you what's going on. And that's a really big issue with the climate change. The other thing that's sort of this weird thing is things that are not understood are considered more fearful. There's a group here, Decision Research here in Eugene, Paul Slovic, and the research he's done on risk perception is really important. It's been really useful. But because climate change is understood, it's predicted, and it's slow, all of those make it less frightening in some ways, and it makes it less imperative to get something done. Earthquakes trigger all of our fear buttons and make it a little bit easier. But at the same time, if you really dig into what's happening with climate change, it's terrifying. And it's because the scientists give you the problem, here's how bad it's going to be. But they have not, in general, wanted to give a solution. That's not our job. The elected officials need to do the policy. We are giving a problem without a solution. And that has been shown clearly by social scientists to increase anxiety and reduce action. So we need to find a way in which the scientists work more closely with the policy people, like I did exploring what the options might be. And doing it in a way, okay, the scientists there say, no, that isn't actually going to work. Let's really think it through. I think the other part is, by not giving the solution, people have had to make up their own ideas about what the solution is. And we've got, you know, ride your Prius, don't take your airplane ride, give up your plastic straws. And that is, well, one thing, it feels like we're giving up modern life. But the real threat to modern life is not dealing with climate change. That's what's going to bring about food availability, famine, disease, climate refugees, and potentially world war. The real threat is not dealing with it, but by not talking about the solutions, we've let people imagine what it is, and they don't realize that it has to be dealt with, that it's going to get as bad as it's going to get, or what those boundaries are. And I think the last thing I'd like to say, we need real dialogue with all the stakeholders. We've got to figure out how to talk about it rather than just leaving it, here's my solution, take it, or, you know, or reject it. How about sitting down with all the people? I know this is going to hurt you to give up this type of, you know, have a carbon tax. What can we do to make it more palatable? Right? Somehow figure out how to have that dialogue with everybody, because we're all going to have to be part of it. Or we're never going to get there. And my last comment, you know, we haven't had the disasters so far, but when they come along, we need to make use of them. Luckily, the scientists are doing a better job now of saying that hurricane is worse because of climate change, right? They were getting asked, did climate change cause that hurricane? And I can't say, I don't know that. So we were saying uncertain. Now they're saying it was made worse by climate change, which is something the scientists are comfortable saying. And the more we say that, and the more we get ready to use the really bad ones that are going to be coming in the next few years, that will be open opportunities to finally get action on climate change. When we scare people with the immediate event and we can't ignore them, we got a lot of work done with earthquakes. Without the big earthquake, I also have things I'd like to see getting through when we have the earthquake to create the opportunity. And the same thing applies to climate change. So thank you. Okay, good.
So we've learned that collaboration works not only in the high desert, but it works in the city of Los Angeles too. The same concepts of getting all the stakeholders involved and solving a problem were evident in LA, like we learned about Mal Ewer. We'll take a 5-minute break and come back for questions.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC, Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Let's get back to the program and thank some of our gold sponsors. The Sapphire sponsor comes from Summit Bank, local community bank, an independent community bank headquartered here in Eugene. Summit Bank serves businesses and professionals in Eugene, Springfield, and Central Oregon. For more information, sbko.bank. And our gold sponsors, Emergency Veterinary Hospital, Oregon Country Fair, Sacred Earth Botanicals. Please limit your questions to 1 minute. Only members of City Club can ask questions. Kitty?
First of all, thank you for your comments today. I'm Kitty Piercy and a longtime member of City Club. As we all are inclined to do, I think I'm more reacting to what you talked about than having a specific question, but I just wanted to make the point that in Oregon, as you indicated, we do have the experience of having statewide dialogue. We had that on our land use policy in the 70s and brought people from all over the state together to talk about the urban growth boundary and how to protect our forest and farmland. So there, we do have a basis and it's been pretty successful, a lot of fights about it, but been pretty successful since the 70s. So, and the result are that a lot of places are protected that aren't protected in other states. So I just put that out there for you to think about and comment on, that we have that experience in our state of dealing with a major challenge in our state.
Great. And I think, looking at the ways in which you can apply that experience, I mean, land use planning and climate change are not unrelated issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Randy?
Randy Prince, City Club member, and active in our neighborhood associations here in Eugene, our efforts to promote preparedness. About how to go about convincing people to do something, those of us who recognize the problem, but here in a place where it hasn't happened, you only see it on TV. And yes, people who have come from California, they are more easily swayed. You mentioned the problems that political leaders have, those who are supposed to be outspoken. It can't happen during their term. We live in a time when there's concern about politicians being fearmongers. On one hand, that wakes you up, but it causes anxiety and lack of action. But if you're too reassuring, nothing happens. So how do you recommend people who, beyond the slower process of collaboration, educate people, inspire people to do something without being written off as fear-mongering?
Well, I think one thing important is actually to not be a fearmonger and not overestimate what the issues are. I mean, when you look at the Cascadia earthquake risk, it is, for one thing, well, don't believe the New Yorker article. The interesting thing about that article I found was that absolutely everything in it was technically correct, each individual sentence, but it was incredibly misleading by omission. In the sense, you know, they made this big point about how much bigger a 9 is than the 8 and all the reasons why Oregon's going to have a 9 and we only have an 8. They didn't mention the fact that the fault's offshore and therefore the shaking and the damage that you receive is substantially less. Eugene is at about intensity 7. That's not magnitude, that's the intensity scale. By comparison, the worst shaking in Northridge was intensity 9. That will not even happen anywhere in the state. That's basically all offshore. And so it made it seem much worse than it is. Not that it's not bad, but you've got to be very careful about what's going in there. I also had somebody really try to encourage me to only use the last few thousand years so you could say the earthquakes were 220 years apart instead of 250, which is cherry picking. And the fact that 250, they can't all be big earthquakes.
It right? did get everybody's attention, though, that article.
It sure got everyone's attention, but did it really change behavior? You're now, you used to have tsunami zones that are now not going to be enforced. So I'm not, they're eliminating, allowing construction in there that they weren't before. So even though it got people's attention, I'm not sure it led to action. Because if it's too bad, you hide your head in the sand because it's impossible. And recognizing it's possible and what you do is reasonable and balanced against your other demands.
Jack.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. I'm a refugee from Los Angeles. And what I was going to ask is relevant to what Randy just said. You know, Paul Slovic, who you mentioned, identified risk perception as two components. One is the magnitude of the event feared, and the other is the probability. And he identified the magnitude as being far more powerful in risk
perception.
So one of the things that I came in late, so maybe you mentioned this, but the one thing that we don't have in Eugene that we did have in Los Angeles is experience of earthquakes. You know, I was there during the Northridge earthquake, and to feel feel everything shaking and see your pots and pans flying off the shelves and so forth is very different than talking about it or the science of it. That is reality,
question,
and all you
please.
Have to do is magnify that a little bit. So how would you suggest dealing with that experiential deficit here?
Well, one thing I didn't actually say that I had been intending to is it used to be that we really needed our own experience to understand it, right? And that there's something called a normalization bias. Basically, if it wasn't in your experience or your parents, maybe your grandparents, if they told really compelling stories, once you're beyond that point, it's not personal, it's not real, you don't act on it. You know, like the fact that the worst disaster in California history is actually a flood, but it was in 1861, 62, we've mostly forgotten, and none of us ever think about it. And the thing that's changed in modern society is we now have globalization, we regularly travel around the world, and we have amazing telecommunications, so that we can directly experience things that are happening elsewhere. And I think the fact, when the Japanese earthquake and tsunami happened in 2011, and you could sit and watch on TV in real time as the waters moved across the Sendai Plain and picked up all those cars and threw them around, it made it much more real. And we now have a lot of stuff being done about tsunamis, even though we haven't experienced one here in the Pacific Northwest since 1700. And yet, you know, a lot of things came out of that, and we started getting, you know, the tsunami zones and all of these other different things. So I think that's the best. It's not, you know, personally having the dishes fly off the shelf and into your head makes more of an impact than watching it on TV. But we are starting to see it and being able to share the experiences from other regions. And I see that's the other reason I think we're finally moving on some of our seismic safety legislation, is people feel closer to watching it happening elsewhere.
Yeah, you mentioned the powers.
Paul. Thank you.
Paul Thompson, City Club member. Thank you so much for coming today. You've given us a number of paradigms, I think, to carry away. One of them is the experiential one that Jack brought up. And our table was talking about how do we get some real life examples, if you will, that would convince people of the validity of what the scientists are coming up with. And there was one concept about having stair-step experiences, if you will. But my question to you is, why don't we have a real-life experience with that's global in nature in the size of the ozone hole over Antarctica? Here's a situation where scientists discovered a problem, prescribed an answer. There was policy that got rid of chlorofluorocarbons, and sure enough, the hole's smaller. Why can't that be used to reinforce people to become believers?
I think we can. It does help, and I've heard it used in discussions more than once. I think it would help if it's put together with a picture. I mean, one of the things that I'm doing, it's back to this, the problem needs to be connected to the solution. So when we convince people there really is a problem and we really are talking about an existential threat to human society, it sounds rather extreme, but I think that's where we are. And then you remind them, we did it with the ozone hole. We did it with smog in LA. I grew up in an LA where we had third degree, you know, smog alerts where they closed the schools because the smog was so bad. And at least until the fires got going, we had pretty much gotten rid of a lot of that in Los Angeles. So we've been able to do it. We need to remind people of that. We got to the moon. We said, here's a technical problem. We have to deal with it. We came together. And somehow, I think at this point, it is more about inspiring people to come together. And in that sense, it's sort of the biggest moral challenge that we've faced, because we are at a point in our society where we don't come together. When people don't agree with us, we want to be angry at them. I have a really hard time dealing with climate change deniers and not just saying, you're stupid. Why should I have to deal with you? But instead, I've got to say, tell me why you don't believe it. Let's help. Let's try and work through it. And somehow, we've got to do this one-on-one and globally. And I think that's part of the challenge. It's really easy to think, I can't do anything. My community can't do it. So what if Oregon reduces its carbon? Look at China. Right, all of those arguments, and yet we've all got to do our part. And there is a, you know, when you look at like LEED standards, things that it took enough people buying into the clean energy standards to make it be accepted. And then, you know, once you've got a critical mass, then you sort of cascade over. And somehow we've got to get a critical mass, not of individuals, but of communities that are working together and reducing their own carbon footprint and connecting to other communities as they do it. And I just hope we get enough done in time.
Ralph Pledger, club member for about 3 years, and you kind of partly answered the question that I was going to ask, but that does happen, doesn't it? We had an earlier forum where the issue of collaboration was central, and you mentioned collaboration. And I'm in thinking about the comparison between earthquake issues and climate change issues. It occurs to me that I don't think we have earthquake deniers out there, do we? I haven't encountered any. Well, maybe we do, but not very many.
You used to. Actually, in the 90s, that was a definite issue when we first came up with the subduction zone. People insisted it wasn't active here in the Pacific Northwest for about a decade.
But of course, they knew that there were transverse fault quakes.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, how do you get over the what I'm claiming is a pretty big difference between the population with respect to earthquakes and climate change, in that in the climate change issue, we have people who actually deny the problem altogether.
I wish I, if I had a better answer to that, I could probably be farther along on this problem. I will say that while we don't have people denying earthquakes, we have plenty of people denying whether the retrofit would actually help. And the feeling, one of the things that's happened is that because, you know, the earthquake happens, the media come over, they want to get us talking because they know they feel better if the scientists, show that someday they understood it. And so they ask us, but how do you get a Caltech nerd to talk? And that's often a challenge. So they ask us, what did you learn in the earthquake? They figured out that gets scientists excited and talking. But what happens then is after every earthquake, we're talking about what we didn't understand about the event rather than what we, you know, the answer that, well, we didn't learn much. We already told you those buildings were bad, right? I've actually started saying that more because I think that that's, we've been communicating the idea that we don't know where the earthquake damage is. And that people don't deny the earthquakes, but they do deny that we know where the problems are. And that was the big thing we were overcoming there. And that's where getting the scientists engaging at a more general level. We're not going to convince everybody, but I think one of the things is the discussion is also shifting. The fires, the change, the weird weather, the extreme hurricanes, people are, you know, it's sort of like having that earthquake under your feet. It's starting to be harder to say it's not there.
John DeLuna, City Club member, and we talked a lot about infrastructure. I was wondering if you had any suggestions for infrastructure for climate change, like where do we go with economic housing? Also, one real quickie, are all the little temblers we're getting on the coast, are they going to slow, decrease the big one a little bit maybe?
No, that's wishful thinking. Yeah. In fact, whenever you have really big ones, you need to have little ones as well. The odder thing is why you have as few little ones as you do. Most subduction zones have more, and that was one of the reasons people thought were trying to claim that it wasn't active till we got the incontrovertible truth, you know, proof about 1700. Infrastructure, that's where the big issue is with climate change, but it's on transportation infrastructure especially. I mean, we're on our way to an electric system that's going to be carbon neutral. It is cheaper to put in a solar plant now than a natural gas-fired plant. We have the capability. We now need to invest in upgrading our infrastructure, and they tend to belong to private utilities. I think there's one of the huge policy issues is that, you know, where's the public-private interface with, the public need to move beyond this. We sort of have the extreme in California right now with the power lines, but it costs a lot of money to bury them, and then it costs more money to maintain them, and yet that's the way we have to do to reduce the fires. So, and it's that public-private tension. The other really big one, I think, on climate that's still a technical problem is we have to figure out how to have carbon-neutral air transportation. Right? That's one of the really big ones, and I don't know what the technical answer is, but we need to find it.
Sandy?
Sandy Erickson. My question is about taking your plan ahead concept and applying it to other social problems. And the social problem I'm working on is homelessness and the concept of prevention. Now, the U.S. is big on emergency services and housing, terrible on prevention. And it fits into your model of, you know, how you...
True on everything, yeah.
Yes, it is true. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about moving that to other areas of social problems, and how do you make that shift?
Boy, I don't think I can solve the world's problems today. I think one comment that strikes me about this, I've thought this before, is that when you look at how we respond to lots of things, I noticed at first with disasters, is that we hate randomness. We are evolved to, when faced with danger, create a pattern that lets us make ourselves safe. We didn't have as big muscles or as strong teeth as all of the other predators out there. We had brains that allowed us to form a pattern and become safer. And so we are pretty deeply wired to face danger with an attempt to make a pattern out of it. And one of the problems is we make a pattern even when it doesn't exist. You know, we create constellations and stars, And when, you know, earthquakes happened and it was completely random, we said God was doing this to us because we had a hard time accepting that it was just random. Because if it's just random, you are at danger at all times. You have no way to make yourself safe, and it increases our anxiety. So we do that. So it's really obvious how we do it with disasters, and different cultures in the world have come up with various supernatural or spiritual interpretations of why disasters happen, because we need that explanation so badly. We do the same thing with human problems. We look at homelessness and say, boy, those people must be lazy. What are their problems? They must have drug problems. Why are they homeless? Because if you can just say, just bad luck means it's going to happen to me, it's too terrifying. So we need to say it's their fault as a reason that it's not going to happen to us. And that colors how we address it. You know, we go and we if it's their fault, you better make sure they can't have drugs when we set up that housing thing. A few communities have actually experimented just by saying, here's a home, it's yours, no requirements. And they reduced their costs. No, and so, but that just, it strikes a lot of people of really wrong and rewarding bad behavior, because we need to believe the people who are suffering did it to themselves, or otherwise it might happen to us.
Quick question, quick answer.
Jerry Smith.
That's the heart of our
question. Thank you so much for your comments on homelessness. I just wanted to know, what do you think is the magnitude of the destruction? I mean, how many people will be made homeless by a massive...
By the Oregon earthquake?
Yeah.
You really need to get the people who studied this. I have skimmed the reports. There's something called Cascadia Rising that was put together as a scenario. And I'm really not... I actually don't think... Well, that answer depends so much on how much retrofitting gets done for the different buildings. That it's pretty hard to say. At intensity 7, which is what's predicted for Eugene, an unreinforced brick building will be badly damaged. Most wooden frame buildings are pretty good. If it's not bolted to the foundation, which only started being required in the 90s, then you could easily lose your house. Whereas if it's bolted, there won't be problems. Intensity 7 is what we get around LA a lot. So that's actually something I understand pretty well. We've required bolting since 1935. You recorded it since the 1990s. You could go and have somebody come and look at your house and see if it's bolted. Single most important thing you can do to protect your own investment.
And if you don't have it bolted, you won't be able to get earthquake insurance.
Good. You shouldn't.
As somebody with a bolted house, I'm very pleased about that. Before we thank our speaker, a few final thank yous. One to KRVM 90.9 Radio, Pack Info and Simplified Computing, LLC, Dot Dotson, Photography, Network Charter School, and KLCC that will broadcast this program Monday night. Next week, we welcome Rodney Price, Chief Operating Officer of eWeb, Joe Carney, Senior Director of Engineering Northwest Natural Gas, as we second part of our disaster program. How we look at our local utilities, and are they prepared for severe weather, wildfires, seismic events, and is your utility disaster resilient? Please join us next week. We'd also like to ask your help. In December, we'll be having our usual Gifts to the City program on December 20th. We want your ideas for speakers. I think the time to submit runs out at the end of this month, so please go to the website and submit your names. Or you can talk to Silver, Eric, or myself. More details and information about future programs on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's thank Dr. Jones for a great program. Thanks a lot.